Our featured guest today, Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors. Well, it's always a pleasure to welcome Bob Hoy back to the show of Institutional Advisors. With all this volatility in the markets today, who better to have on the show? Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Chris, good to be with you and with your listeners.
Well, I bet you're watching this Grexit drama over the weekend and actually for several months on and off. Oh, nothing to worry about. There won't be any trouble. Please keep your money in our banks. All kinds of calming comments over the weekend by officials. And then boom, Monday, the banks are closed down and you've got a Cypriot moment all over again. Tell us what's going on.
Well, I saw one a couple of weeks ago that seemed plausible that, well, of course, the Greek government is going to stall as long as they can. But in the meantime, it was allowing a lot of people to withdraw money and savings and transfer, you know, just get it released ready so they can put their hands on it. But it was an experiment gone bad. You have, under the umbrella of the EU, everybody expected to have much lower yields, and spreads would narrow. So, and you end up with a system where the weaker members end up with the ability to borrow way much more money than if each of these countries was borrowing on their own behalf, so to speak. Also, the EU agreement on budget deficits at 3% of GDP and all that sort of stuff, they all sounded good when they put it down on paper, but there was no discipline there to enforce it. There would have been more discipline had they been on a gold standard, because then that, well, back in the days when gold standards were on, they were marvelous devices to constrain government. So you've had all the recklessnesses of 100 years of experiment in authoritarian government, where each country went authoritarian, each in its own way, and you had eager central bankers there, quite willing to underwrite an experiment in unlimited government. And what do those guys do in order to provide unlimited funding? Well, it's unlimited credit. So here we are. It's not at the season where things can go wrong. So our view on the stock markets, they call it outlier markets, because you can no longer call, say, Shanghai a junior market, but let's say London and New York are the senior markets. Well, these are not senior markets, and the tradition of great financial manias is that in Europe and London, over the centuries, they had a tendency to do a speculative blow-off in May or June of the year. Then in 1873, the U.S. New York market had become big enough to be noticeable. So the 1873 bubble, then came the difference in pattern where the New York Stock Exchange was firm going right into September and then crashed. Then 1929, similar things, Europe and London peaked in the May, June, did it around during the summer, and then New York made its high in September. And then moving along right to 2007, which was a classic financial mania, bubble, real estate, commodities going, stocks, everything much like 1929. So then you had the high in New York in October, not too far off of the September target. So here we are. We still say that this is the first bull market and the first business recovery out of a classic crash. And for a year now, the New York Stock Exchange has been showing at times very elevated sentiment and momentum figures. I mean, this elevation has been sustained for a long time. But we go back to last fall, which was the last test of everybody's nerve, and into October, which is often seasonally weak, and it can often end declines. And one of our proprietary models in October kicked off a springboard buy. So then we looked around and said, oh, here we are, October is a weak month. We got the springboard buy. We had a couple of tools to say the stock market would be good maybe out till March, and one target, and then probably May on the old seasonal thing in May. So here we are. So they crack in the markets over the weekend with the possibility that they would pull the pin on Greece. I think it's mainly to do with the financial markets rather than the news event. You had Shanghai market go up and make a huge high. Same with Hong Kong.
But, you know, we recently had a 20% plus pullback from the highs there in the past couple of weeks. Is that presenting a buying opportunity, or is that the bubble?
The way we looked at Shanghai was that probable high in June needed one more. We have another model action that we call upside exhaustion when it reads that. So we were looking for the third cluster of upside exhaustion readings, which we got in June, but it wasn't a cluster of them, it was just one, and that turned to be enough. So then the other day we put, on Sunday or Saturday, put one out that showed that the slump in Shanghai had reached our target and that we'd probably get a relief rally out of it, which is happening. Considering how bad North American markets were into yesterday's close, and then you looked overnight in Asia, and they're up strongly. So, yeah, this is a technical hit after technical excesses on the upside. This can recover for a while. It just depends. If they go straight up for a couple of days, that would do it. But we hope that it recovers more slowly and turns around through the summer months. So the same thing we're looking at on the New York market, on the IBB, the biotechs, which has been a fabulous one. Yeah. It gave an upside exhaustion some time ago, came down to a target level. And we think that this thing now, somewhere like, July 20th into late August, early September, is a very good seasonal for biotechs with various conventions and forums and new products and all that sort of stuff. So there's a positive seasonal for the biotech. So, and then we just looked at the margin, NYSE margin outstanding. It's always a month behind. So the April figure has just come out today. The May figure has just come out today. So that makes April a spike up for margin. And if you look at previous spike-ups for margin 2007, for example, the actual high on the senior index wasn't until some months later. And then we're also on the senior index looking at the New York Stock Exchange advanced decline line, and it has been heading down since April. But in the last few weeks, it really has stepped down, zigzagged down. So it's well tested on the way below. So it's now in a decline. As a matter of fact, I looked at the relative strength line, the RSI on it, and we found that the 35-week RSI had provided good support on each of the corrections over the last couple of years. And like, for example, particularly in last October, when the advanced decline lines went down, they went down and bounced off the 35-week moving average. And this time, as the last couple of days, it's gone below. So there's another technical deterioration that is important. So let's wrap up the stock market. So I'd said the big speculative burst was likely to complete, let's call it a thrust. Big speculative thrust was likely to complete around June, and whatever indexes reach there and then correct. The outlying indexes, like Hong Kong and Shanghai, Europe, were also likely to peak in June and then correct. So our theme here on the stock market side is the big speculative energy is blowing on it and churning around during the summer. New York senior index will likely make another try for highs going into late August, early September. I mean, that's a classic timing, isn't it? Then underneath this, we've got the credit spreads, and that's the one thing. Central banks have been able to lower interest rates, and they've been artificially lowering interest rates for a long time, particularly the Fed. But as the business cycle shows and the credit market cycle shows, they really can't do anything about credit spreads. When they're narrowing, everybody's positive, and they narrowed here into a few weeks ago into May and then turned up. So credit spreads have been widening. They took a good correction in the last few weeks. Then in the last few trading days have widened out to new wides. Let's call it new wides for the move. It's similar to action in credit spread to this time in 1998, and that's when the big sure thing was that the European interest rates for different countries were narrowing because that was the EU was doing that. And a huge hedge fund then, LTCM, Long-Term Capital Management, got on board, and it was such a sure thing that even the senior central banks loaned money to this highly leveraged fund. And so the credit spread we watch is acting very similar to what it was doing in June of 1998. And then because we got up to date on it a few days ago, where the credit spread widening didn't get uncomfortable for most players until well into July of 1998, LTCM was reporting losses in May and June, so the adversity was going against them then. And then, of course, after the end of July or late in July, it just became a panic. And then there was the discovery of some inability of the Russians to maybe service their debt, and it became a free for all. I remember Citigroup fell more than 40% on that when it crashed down to October. So, anyways, credit spreads are now widening, similar to the summer months of previous big ending bubble years. So that's another worry. And we keep watching base metals, of course. We were looking for a rotation where some of the beat-up commodities could rally out of December out to around May. Base metals had a good run. Their mining stocks had a good run and became kind of overbought at targets in May, and we just advised, you know, taking the money off the table. The gold sector, precious metal sector, was kind of late getting going on that move, and then when it moved far too fast, right up into early February, I think it was, and then back down, and then some of them set new lows. So then the next rally on that one, in the precious metal sector, we just said, take some money off the table. And then the final rally in there was into May. Got some overbought there and was to take some money off the table there as well. So you could say that we're not long, not short precious metals. We think that all investors should own a little gold as an insurance policy, you know, and back up liquidity. But we wouldn't look at it as a way to make money. That's just a straight currency play. And one of the problems in every post-bubble contraction has been that the senior currency becomes chronically strong or firm against most other currencies and most other commodities. And I think that's still going to happen. So if you've got people trading gold and silver in order to make money out of them as if they were a commodity, I don't think you'll make much money. Maybe even lose a little. So then let's look forward to what happens, say, after late August. If the big stock market turns down, then the gold stocks, although they're lowish and, you know, whatnot, beat up, everything else, well, they're not going to rally in the face of a heavy liquidation problem in the fall. So I hate to say it, but I can't get excited about the precious metal sector. Other than, you know, one of the ways, Chris, to look at it is the gold-silver ratio has been it acts like a credit spread. So if you're in a boom and credit is expanding and everybody's having fun, then silver will outperform gold and your gold-silver ratio will go down. And then if you look just at the ratio itself and it starts to turn up, then it gives that's sort of saying maybe the party's going to diminish, although the party may be elsewhere. But I've watched, gone through the history on it maybe about 300 years, and it's consistent. So at the moment, this week, you've got the gold-silver ratio up at 65, and if it breaks out from this level, then it would be giving a warning on what's going on in the credit market. This is a reliable indicator, and it needs to really break above 76 to give a warning. But one of the things that the service that the gold-silver ratio does, even just as it becomes volatile, it suggests that something's starting to change. So back in April, it was at 76. Then in May, it was down to 69. Now we're up to 75. That's fairly volatile. So we may want to make money out of gold and silver, but at the moment, it's going to be a very good indicator for us and protecting us in other sectors of investment. So yeah, you can put that as a line in the sand. If it breaks above 76, it'll be saying, watch out in the credit markets. No idea if and when it'll do it, but if it does it. And then if you get one of these days where gold could be steady, priced in U.S. dollars, and if silver's down, say, 1% against that, then that's a warning coming in as well. It's fascinating to watch that one. I guess we've done that. We've done stock markets, and when there was a scare in the markets, as there was over the weekend, and you got a good rally out of the U.S. long bond, but that bond rally, or the bond is capable of rallying maybe for the next 4 or 5 weeks or so on each little setback in stock markets on as it turns around through the summer. But if we go into a liquidity problem in the fall, even long treasuries won't be able to rally through that kind of stuff. So, because when it gets to a serious liquidity problem, the serious money goes to the most liquid items, which would be U.S. treasury bills and gold. And by definition, the most liquid item is the one that's not going to change too much in price as you go in and out of it. So, I can see the investment demand for gold going up mainly because of the liquidity it provides. But I still wouldn't play it trying to make money against the U.S. dollar on it. So
what I'd like to do is shift over to some of the topicality and tie that in with the markets this week. You know, we hear a lot about the Greek drama and the stress that's putting on the European Union, certainly intense. There is also talk of some of the other BRICS nations that could come under fire. One that I think is flying under the radar here that's remarkably similar in North America, we have Puerto Rico. There's not a lot of news on this, but Puerto Rico is facing billions of dollars. It's just defaulted, as I understand it, or is about to default on tens of billions of dollars in debt. There's no way with our current legal system for that to be wiped off the books. And it looks as though this province of the United States could become our Greece. And I'd like your thoughts on how that might impact the markets.
Chris, I'm glad you brought that one up because I agree with you on that. And I'd extend it a little further to say that there are many cities and counties in the United States that have been living the good life. Pension funds for their municipal workers are just right out of sight, obligations and all that sort of stuff. That's very risky. But I did look it up last week. There was a land bubble that blew out in 1837. And with that land bubble, people were forming banks and using land as a collateral kind of thing, a reserve. And a number of states did some way or another buy into the bubble and ended up with lending the money or whatever and and it was borrowing money to, anyways, it was all mixed up. But at any rate, then 1840-41, it all came apart, and there was a great crash of bond prices and everything else, and obligations where Alabama and whatnot owed this money, and what are they going to do with it? But Florida played it interestingly, because when the debt was taken on, Florida was the territory. So then what got me going on this was because the other week, the Greeks, of course, were defending themselves and saying that this is their debt burden. They called it odious debt, not because it stinks, but because it was an obligation assumed by a previous government, so that they have this quasi-legal out where they can say, oh, this is odious debt, and we're not going to honor it. Well, in the case of Florida in 1841, it was, oh, we were a territory where we legally couldn't borrow money. But nevertheless, the banks and the lenders loaned the money, and they took it and blew it on who knows whatever, and then you have the pain and repercussions afterwards. So, yeah, I think one way to watch that, Chris, is, as on the stock exchange, the ETF for municipal debt is the MUB. And you can do it relative to TLT, which is the ETF for the 10-year note. Or maybe it's a 20-year, I can't remember. But anyways, that's the way to watch the spread. And if MUB starts to really fall in price relative to treasuries, that's another sign that the market's starting to get worried about the immense debt burdens that many counties and municipalities have. It's not like a debt burden where there may be bonds there, I don't know, maybe they borrowed money, but the burden is also these huge pension benefits that retired municipal workers have obtained through union pressures. So they some of them, I read, that they can retire and be getting more money per year than the average taxpayer earns. So there was the distortion of power there, monopolistic powers of the unions in cities and in counties. There's going to be a huge reconciliation there.
I also wanted to touch base a bit on the threat of looming higher interest rates. Listening to some of the hawkish talk coming from a couple of the key Fed governors following the last FOMC meeting, it certainly looks as though we should expect a September rate hike as well as a December rate hike instead of the one and done, two and done. Do you suspect that the Fed recognizes that the risk in these markets, the risk trade is obviously back on? What do you think this portends for the markets? Will we see huge capital flows from debt instruments into equities, or has that already been baked into the market?
No, that's already in, but your first part of the question was about watching what the Fed was going to do in raising interest rates. Now, everybody is trying to anticipate what the Fed is going to do. But if you take a look at the course of, we got two kinds of interest rates out there. One is market rates of interest, such as T-bill rates or commercial paper rates or 10-year stuff. Then you have administered rates, which is what the central bank does with its rates. What the senior central bank has done in periods of bubble land, back to when the Bank of England could actually change their interest rates, 1870s boom, that at key points, either to rising interest rates or lowering them, the senior central bank has been 3 or 4 months behind the change in market rates of interest. Okay, now this is what the point to be made, is that there is no point even wondering what the Federal Reserve is going to do about administered rates, because whatever they do, the market rates of interest will have changed 3 or 4 months before when they finally move. Like, the big telltale in 1929 was that Treasury bill rates went up until April of that year. Now, for any trader in the markets, And when the speculation is going straight up, interest rates, short-dated rates, will be going up as well because speculators are borrowing money to speculate with. So, and yet, the professional Wall Street economists all worry about rising interest rates. They go up. So the key in 1929 was April, May, when the T-bill rate turned down. So then in August that year, the Fed changed the discount rate from 5 to 6%. And when the crash started, they lowered it and they followed. So they ended up following down the T-bill rate. So this, I refuse to even talk about whether the Fed's going to do with their Fed funds rate and everything else, because it is just all bureaucratic ritual with absolutely no consequence whatsoever. You're better off to look at commercial paper rates and just, we don't play that game. There's no way, because history is convincing on this. The senior central bank has been behind the market.
Okay, let's talk a bit about the precious metals sector. You touched on it just a bit. From a fundamental perspective, at least, this would indicate some values are starting to crop up in our gold mining sector. There's certainly some fine companies there and some excellent management, a lot of great engineers on many of these companies. Give us an idea of when you see the sector finding a bottom. Are we going to have to wait for the Fed to pull the trigger on rates and get past that first?
So the guide we used for March, November, published the last study on it, was that you want to see gold stocks outperforming bullion price, and you want to see silver outperforming gold, which we got coming out of Christmas, and then that's no longer the case. So those are the benchmarks we would look for. Now, there are great companies out there. There are great properties. Outstanding management, they're getting more experience every quarter. But until the market changes, we're going into a point. Say you get a liquidity problem in the fall. Well, then the consumption of jewelry is going to diminish. And then the World Gold Council hangs its whole hat and everything else on jewelry consumption of gold. And that'll head down. But in the meantime, if you're into a contraction, the investment demand for gold will rise. But that doesn't mean it's going to drive it up in terms of your favorite currency. What we watch is the real price of gold, deflated by the CPI, or as we do it, against our own commodity index. And you want to see that beginning to move up quite vigorously, but that gold divided by commodities thing here. Just a minute, I'll bring it up. Rallied up to the 22nd, and then started coming down a bit here. But it has been a sideways trend since February, so it's not telling us anything. So when we are ready to enter, when we see things improving to enter the gold and silver markets, and we would favor gold and silver stocks over the metal prices themselves, other than your insurance policy with gold, we'll be doing reports and studies on it. But until it changes, we're not going to move.
With regard to the equities rally, we've certainly seen one of the most impressive rallies since the late 1990s. You touched a little bit on Asia as well. You don't sound too sanguine on the prospects, to put it mildly.
Sanguine, yeah. Say, that was a research analyst. I always used to use that term some time ago.
Well, what I like to say is, well, sounding a bit more sanguinary than you are sanguine.
Well, what is it? The old one was lithic exsanguinity, where the bankers are trying to get blood out of rocks. So that's in a contraction. Speculative trust into June that was likely has been accomplished. The hit to these markets yesterday is a heads up on it. Shanghai got oversold and can turn around for a while. So the stock market think turn around through the summer. New York will make another attempt at highs, maybe even make highs, but it'll be more like a testing of the market by the time you get to end of summer, early September. And if this credit spread continues to widen quietly through the summer, all it has to do is keep widening, then that's our warning signal. We'll be covering it in our publications, so, this is all ahead of us.
Please tell people more about the services you provide and how they can contact you if they're so inclined.
Regularly, Thursday, publish a piece that covers interest rates, commodities, metal prices, credit spreads, stock markets, whatever is moving, currencies, and the precious metal sector. And that's regular, usually 4 or 5 pages it goes out. And then we have the technical side, which is opportunistic. So, like, here's how it works. Our regular weekly piece is pounding along looking for a big speculative high in June. And then we've got the technical side that was saying earlier in the year we're getting the upside exhaustions we needed, and we were looking for one more set of upside exhaustions, which we got. So then the ChartWorks comes out with that saying, here's where the trade is. And then, as I say, a couple of days ago, came up with the one on the buy on the Shanghai. So you end up with a long-term view with actually very good technical support when you get to the major turning point. So you can look it up at institutionaladvisors.com, or actually just my name, Bob Hoy, and it all comes in. We put you on for a no-charge trial for 4 or 5 weeks.
As we wrap up here, there's one other thing I meant to mention. One of our sponsors here, Peter Spina, over at the Gold Forecaster, for our listeners who are interested in high-flying, small-cap mining companies for the most part, that's your go-to source. His work is indicating deflation, and we're certainly seeing signs of that. The greenback in one of the strongest rallies of any currency we've seen in a decade at least hints at the potential for a 2008 style deflation, even if it's just temporary. Are you seeing anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Crash, 1938 type of setback. Plus, you've had to the moon on Asian markets, so they would then be a 1930s type of setback. And here's where I want to mention the real price of gold. Is this is how you make money in the precious metals in a deflationary environment, is that the price of everything falls relative to the price of gold. So if you got the mining costs for gold miners going down relative to the price, they make money. So if the price of gold in dollars for North American producers doesn't matter so long as their costs are falling, and I believe that their costs would be held in line here recently, but so that's the point. That's why we always use the real price of gold. So here's one for your listeners: that every post bubble deflation has lasted for some 20, 25 years after the bubble. The key bubble blew out in 2007, so you got interruptions with the business cycle. But then the real price of gold goes up. Global unemployment gets tougher, higher and higher, and on that thing. So each of the major gold rushes, like 1849 in California, and then 1895 in the Yukon and in Australia, those were at depression bottoms when the real price was at its best and unemployment was at its worst. So you have unemployed men looking for a high-priced product, gold, and what happens? You find a lot of it. So these are the good times in the precious metal sector ahead of us. But in between, it's going to be very lumpy.
Excellent. Bob Hoy, we thank you so much.
Good to be with you, Chris.